Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the New York Society Library. It's so wonderful to see such a big crowd tonight, every chair taken and more. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. It's a real pleasure to welcome you all and thank all of you library members for your support that makes evenings like this one possible. Before we have the introduction of our speaker, I just do want to tell you that we actually have, if you want to take home some reading after the event tonight, we have a nice little paperback of Marcel. It's my pleasure to now introduce our speaker.
Well, I'm delighted. As Mark said, we have so many Proustians here tonight. And I know some of you have read this great work five or six times. So we have a lot of experts here. And I hope you have all enjoyed your Madeleine and that it brings back wonderful memories. But I hope the memory doesn't take as long as Monsieur Proust, because we want to be sure to listen to Anka as she gives her brilliant talk tonight. And it is such a pleasure and an honor to welcome such a distinguished writer and scholar as Anka Mühlstein. As we discussed, as Mark mentioned, we depend on the generosity of our members, and I would like to thank Anka so much for her generosity in contributing her honorarium tonight as a gift to our wonderful library. Ms. Mühlstein was born in Paris and has lived in New York with her husband Louis Begley since 1974. As I mentioned some of her titles, I apologize for my accent, both to Monsieur Proust and to Anka. She has published an essay on women in power at the court of Louis XIV, and one on Manhattan, biographies of Queen Victoria, James de Rothschild, Adolphe de Custine, published by my former publishing partner, Helen Marks, who is here tonight, a study on Catherine de' Medici, Marie de' Medici, and Anne of Austria, Reine Éphémère, Mère Perpétuelle, a double biography of Elizabeth Tudor and Mary, Queen of Scots, The Perils of Marriage. Her latest book is Napoléon à Moscou. She has just finished a book on food and Balzac, which I can hardly wait for, and we can look forward to it to appear in France and Germany this year, and hopefully later in the United States. Anka Mühlstein has won two prizes from the Académie Française and the Goncourt Prize for Biography. She also contributed with her usual brilliance to a book which I self-servingly mentioned because I published it along with Helen Marks and John Rabinowitz and Farrar, Straus and Giroux, a book called The Proust Project, where we asked authors to pick their favorite passage and explain why. And in her essay, she refers to the similarities of the great salonnières, Madame Verdurin, and the Princesse de Guermantes. And in the passage, she selects Proust references Hardy, Dostoevsky, Gogol, and Stendhal, among many others. So now let us welcome Anka Mühlstein.
Thank you, Danette. People don't know how to read anymore, declared Proust to his editor Jacques Rivière. And he set out to illustrate this statement by cataloging all the bad readers he could possibly imagine in his great novel. Everybody reads In Search for Lost Time, masters, servants, old and young. But do they really read? The footman, excuse me. Do you hear me like that? Is it better? No? Do you hear me? Yes? No? Now? Is this better? Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. A young footman steals books from the narrator's library. But is it to read them? No, he likes to pluck out poetic quotes to insert in the letters he writes home. The Duc de Guermantes makes a show of retreating to his library to avoid his wife's guests and in order to read is that all his books... Whoops. Shall I hold this one? Try this one instead. Okay. There. Shall I hold it? Is this better?
No?
Okay. Now, do you hear me? What? I can't. I mean, I'm touching it, really. So the Duke reads Balzac, says he. The only problem is that all his books are bound in the same blonde calf leather. So he confuses Balzac with third-rate novelists. Now, of course, these are caricatures, but actually, Proust was very serious about how people read. His friend Saint-Loup, you know, a very brilliant, well-educated young man, is only interested in the politics, in the intellectual and the politics contents of a book. The university professor, Brichot, is obsessed with grammatical purity. And so he's completely unable to appreciate Balzac because of the clumsy and sometimes hasty style of the novelist. Bloch, another one of the narrator's friend, is passionately interested in the formal beauty of words. So he claims that the most beautiful verses in the French languages are the ones that don't mean anything. And finally, not finally, Madame de Brissac, who is a friend of the Guermantes, is just repulsed by Victor Hugo because he's interested in the hardships of life. What she likes is to be taken away from the ugliness of life when she reads a book. She's only interested in the subject, proving herself just as silly as the Duke, who refuses to buy a wonderful still life done by Elstir, a still life of asparagus. Why should I pay 300 francs for a bunch of asparagus, he claims, as an explanation. Of course, the ultimate reading sin is committed by Madame de Villeparisis. Madame de Villeparisis, you may recall, is a very aristocratic lady. She is the aunt of the Duchess of Guermantes. She's very learned. She's a talented painter. Her father presided over a political and literary salon. But she only judges contemporary authors by the figure they cut in society. Vigny, who incidentally was one of Proust's favorite poets, Vigny was such a bore, she would say, and besides, he didn't know how to hold his hat. And Balzac, what a ridiculous little man, always dressed in such an outrageous fashion. And besides, he wasn't even received in the society he describes. Madame de Villeparisis represents here the theories of the critic Sainte-Beuve. Sainte-Beuve considered that in all order to judge an author, you had to take into account his politics, his religion, his relation with his friends and his family. And this was absolute anathema to Proust. And Proust actually wrote an essay titled Against Sainte-Beuve, Contre Sainte-Beuve, that was published posthumously. Because for Proust, an artist, a real artist, reveals his inner self, his hidden self, the self that is never shown in society, that doesn't appear in conversation, not even in correspondence. Of course, there is a group of passionate readers in the novel. And they form what Proust calls une franc-maçonnerie des lettrés, a sort of secret society that binds improbable friends. For instance, Swann, you know, the elegant Parisian. Why does he like so much to go and chat with the no-nonsense provincial grandfather? Well, because they both like Saint-Simon so much. How did Swann spark a friendship with the Baron Charlus? Because of their common taste for Balzac. And I think the most improbable combination comes from Charlus. Charlus, you know, is this rather violent, aggressive grandee, and the modest and unassuming grandmother. After a conversation about Madame de Sévigné, the grandmother discovers in him, under his abrasiveness, a delicacy and a sensitivity that not many people discover. But all these people read for fun. Reading for them is a pastime. It doesn't lead to this big, deep, introspective effort that for Proust marks a good reader, a reader like himself, like Marcel Proust. So how did Proust read? Well, as a child, he read, like most of us, for the plot, for the characters. But he always read extremely seriously, and he was outraged by the fact that his great aunt considered reading an amusement. My great aunt, he recalled in Days of Reading, would say to me, "How can you go on amusing yourself with a book? It isn't Sunday, you know." Putting into the word amusing an implication of childishness and waste of time. For little Marcel, reading was traumatic, and at the end of a book, he always melted in tears and he couldn't go to sleep because he was so sorry to part with these characters, the characters for whom he had sobbed and yearned. Never again hear of them, one would have so much liked for the book to continue. As a schoolboy, he was introduced to the classics and introduced to the formal beauty of texts, and that is where he gained his passion for Racine and for Saint-Simon. He adored it. He read them not so much at first for the intellectual and emotional contents, but really for the formal beauty of a language that was disappearing, for the language in which they were written, something of the happiness one feels walking in a town like Beaune, whose 15th century hospice has been preserved intact, can be felt while wandering in the midst of a tragedy by Racine or a volume of Saint-Simon. He read as a moralist, for as long as reading is for us the instigator whose magic keys have opened the door to these dwelling places deep within us, then we would not have known how to enter. Its role in our lives is salutary. It becomes dangerous, on the other hand, when instead of awakening us for the personal life of the mind, reading tends to take its place, when the truth appears as something material deposited between the leaves of a book, like honey fully prepared by others. Then he also read as a novelist, or rather as an artisan of the written world, and he analyzed endlessly authors, whether he liked them or not. And this was a danger for him because imitation came so quickly to Proust. His inner metronome, as he called it, would pick up immediately the rhythm of the author he was reading. And so to cleanse himself, he wrote pastiche. It was the only way for him to get rid of these characteristics. And he published these pastiches. He wrote pastiche of Balzac, of Flaubert, of Saint-Simon, of a slew of other authors. He published them separately. But in the novel, there is one avowed pastiche, that of the brothers Goncourt, and quite a few hidden ones. And then he read as a homosexual, as I will show in analyzing the way he read Balzac and Racine. I won't go in so much into who were his favorite writers, because there were so many of them. But I do want to say, before I turn exclusively to the French writers, how much he was moved by Anglo-Saxon and Russian literature. It's curious that in all the different genres, from George Eliot to Hardy, from Stevenson to Emerson, there is no literature which has had as much hold on me as English or American literature. Germany, Italy, very often France, leaves me indifferent, but two pages of Mill on the Floss reduce me to tears. And he does not even mention here Poe or Ruskin. He was very, very interested in Henry James for technical reasons, I would say. He reread very, very carefully what Maisie knew, because he wanted to know how James pulled off a novel seen by one and only one character. And of course he loved the Russians. He considered Tolstoy a serene god, but he didn't write much about Tolstoy. He did write a lot about Dostoevsky, and Dostoevsky does have a place in the novel, as it is the subject of the real literature courses that the narrator inflicts on his girlfriend, Albertine. But the writers that really are woven into the book, that are important to the novel, are really all French. I think I am going to start by Chateaubriand, because Chateaubriand is in a category apart. I think that if I asked you what is the best known episode of In Search of Lost Time, you would probably answer the episode of the Madeleine. You know how the taste of the little cake melting in hot tea brings back all the childhood memories. What happens here is a huge switch in time. It's a long, long flashback. And it is not easy to bring about a flashback naturally, so to say. In this case, it is the taste that does it. He was not the first one to use one of the senses to operate this kind of switch. Chateaubriand did it before him, but in the case of Chateaubriand, it is the sound. And Proust acknowledges absolutely in the most straightforward way in his novel his debt to Chateaubriand in this technical ploy. Is not the most beautiful part of the Mémoire d'Outre-Tombe assimilable with my sensations relative to the Madeleine? And he quotes the passage. Yesterday evening, I was walking alone. I was drawn from my reflections by the warbling of a thrush perched upon the highest branch of a birch tree. At that instant, the magical sound brought my paternal home before my eyes. I saw again that country where so often I heard the thrush sing. But this direct homage to a predecessor is an exceptional occurrence. All the other writers are really more linked to different characters in the book than in the art of writing. Let's start with Madame de Sévigné. Madame de Sévigné is exclusively in the domain of the grandmother and the mother of the narrator. In the first part of the book, it is really the grandmother that reads Madame de Sévigné all the time. Then she dies, and her daughter takes over her muff, her purse, her handbag, and of course, the volume of Sévigné. But the two women don't read at all in the same way. The grandmother immerses herself in Madame de Sévigné as if she was reading herself, says Proust. Her attitude is that of total empathy, so much so that she doesn't even want to argue with her friend Madame de Villeparisis, who considers that the love of the mother for the daughter is exaggerated. And as I mentioned, she is delighted to notice that Charlus understands Sévigné and, as she says, proves a feminine sensitivity. Little did she know how right she was. The mother reads completely differently because the mother uses Madame de Sévigné. We all know that Madame de Sévigné had a daughter, but she also had a son, a lazy, spendthrift son. So whenever the mother of the narrator is really irritated by the lazy habits of her son, the narrator, instead of confronting him directly, she uses Madame de Sévigné. And I have to say that the quotes are marvelously chosen and quite cruel. "Without referring to what distressed her most," writes the narrator, "she said that she was annoyed by my lavish expenditure. 'Where on earth does all your money go? It is distressing enough that, like Charles de Sévigné, you do not know what you want and are two or three people at once. But do try at least not to be like him in spending money, so that I may never have to say of you, he has discovered how to spend and has nothing to show, how to lose without staking and how to pay without clearing himself of debt. So you see, Proust does use Madame de Sévigné to depict the character of the two women. The mother is a bit devious, and she lacks the wonderful simplicity and transparency of the grandmother. Now, of course, Saint-Simon is used differently. Saint-Simon is all over the place, if only because half of the names chosen by Proust come out of Saint-Simon. Now, Saint-Simon is not exactly what we would call a quick read. I mean, you know, the memoirs of the court of Louis XIV add up to more than 20 volumes. So obviously, only two or three personages in the novel have really read Saint-Simon. That is Swann, Charlus, and the narrator, who quote him with the utmost ease. Swann, the bourgeois art lover, he's the bourgeois pet of the Guermantes, and he observes with delectation the way the Guermantes would be completely at ease at the court of Louis XIV and are absolutely scandalized that the privileges they would have enjoyed in the 17th century are not respected in the 19th century. They act as if they were in Saint-Simon. The younger brother of the Duc de Guermantes, the Baron Charlus, is even more Saint-Simon than his older brother. And both the narrator and Swann observe him also with great pleasure, because Charlus, who considers his family more ancient and more precious than that of the King of France, takes himself for a personage of the memoir. With the singular amalgam that he had made of the social conceptions at once of a great nobleman and an amateur of the arts, instead of being polite in the same way that a man of his world would be, he would create a sort of tableau vivant for himself after Saint-Simon, which of course included an extraordinary touchiness about his rank. I'm sure that you all remember the amazing scene at the Verdurin. The Verdurin also, the bourgeois sort of nouveau riche who failed to seat Charlus properly at their table. And Charlus erupts in a sort of long rambling about his family, its extraction, its alliances, and he ends up by rattling off all his title, exactly the way the Duke of Saint-Simon would do whenever a breach of the proper etiquette had been committed. But it is not only in observing the nobles that Saint-Simon appears in the novel. Not very many people would find something common between Combray, the sleepy little town where the narrator and his family spend their vacation, and the court of Louis XIV. Well, Proust does, with the help of Saint-Simon. I have to say that Proust worked tirelessly at these improbable rapprochements because he liked to prove that the same laws applied to people in different, very different circumstances. So he describes the life in Combray in the style of Saint-Simon. For instance, the invalid aunt Léonie, who never goes outside. Her day is as precisely organized as that of Louis XIV. Her power over her servant is as strong, as heavy as the power of Louis XIV on his courtiers. He shows that in the provinces, no tweak of etiquette was ever allowed. No lapse is allowed. People at Combray might have kind hearts, sensitive natures, might have adopted the most perfect theories of human equality. My mother, when a footman became emancipated, began to say you and slipped out of the habit of addressing me in the third person, was moved by these presumptions to the same wrath that breaks out in Saint-Simon's memoir whenever a nobleman who is not entitled to it seizes a pretext for assuming the style of highness in an official document or for not paying dukes the deference he owes to them and is gradually beginning to lay aside. Now, the interest of the grandfather of the narrator in genealogies, in families, in fortune, in alliances, of course, mirror the preoccupations of Saint-Simon and also those of Charlus. So let us not leave Charlus too quickly, because there's a lot of Saint-Simon in Charlus, but there's also a lot of Balzac. Now, Proust had mixed feelings towards Balzac. He did not adore Balzac, but he admired the inventiveness, the power of the novelist. He, of course, admitted that it was a stroke of genius to have the different characters sort of show up in different books. But he was sort of taken aback also by the clumsy style, also by the fact that Balzac explains a lot all the emotions instead of simply evoking them the way Proust does. And then, of course, Balzac's obsession with money was completely foreign to Proust. In Proust, money is abstract. You never know how it happens that the narrator is able of giving those amazingly expensive presents to Albertine. Where does the huge fortune of the Verdurin come from? Nobody knows, and nobody will ever know. This is very un-Balzac. But the answer lies in the three books that Proust really analyzes. They are Lost Illusions, The Girl with the Golden Eyes, and a novella called The Secrets of the Princess de Cadignan. Of course, Lost Illusions is the story of the homosexual love of Vautrin, the escaped convict for the young poet Lucien de Rubempré. The Girl with the Golden Eyes is the story of a lesbian passion. And The Princess de Cadignan is the story of a duchess who had a rather agitated youth and who now that she has attained the ripe old age of 30 is in love with a writer, and she is terrified that this austere and virtuous man is going to discover something about her rather loose past. And this is a fear that, of course, the fictional Charlus and the real-life Proust understand very well, because they were under the illusions that their homosexuality was not known to everybody, and they were always afraid to be found out. So Proust wrote once that we read the classics in the light of our own obsessions. And this is certainly the way he read Balzac. He admired immensely the courage of the old novice of Balzac in describing passions that describe passions which the rest of the world ignores or studies only to castigate them. He admired the way he described le quartier des tantes, the quarter of the fairies in French jails, and also the perspicacity that he showed in depicting certain gestures of Vautrin that allowed readers in the know to discover his homosexuality. But he did it in a very, very discreet way. And actually, Proust admired so much the famous scene where Vautrin picks up Lucien at the side of the road only because he's so moved by the physical beauty of the young man that he recreated the scene when Charlus falls for Morel on the platform of the Doncière station. Now, actually, Charlus could very well have been created by Balzac, because Charlus has the immense power, the will of Vautrin that we see when he builds up the career of Morel, his young lover who's a violinist. And he also, in his final degradation, Charlus evokes Le Baron Hulot, you know, the character of La Cousine Bette, who cannot be trusted with any skirt, the way Charlus cannot be left with any young boy. There is something absolutely... So it is not so surprising that Proust gives Charlus the role of the Balzac specialist in the novel. And Charlus really plays it with great gusto. In Sodom and Gomorrah, he encourages the narrator to read Lost Illusions. What? You have never read Illusion Perdue? But it's wonderful. And the death of Lucien? I forgot who was the man of taste, and Proust adds, the man of taste was of course Oscar Wilde, was who, when he was asked what event in his life had most distressed him, replied, the death of Lucien de Rubempré in Splendeur et Misère. Another novel in which Charlus is immersed is The Secrets of the Princesse de Cadignan. What a masterpiece, how profound, how heart-rending the evil reputation of Diane. Diane is the heroine, who is afraid that the man she loves may hear of it. What an eternal truth, and more universal that might appear, how far it extends. Of course, Charlus at the time was afraid that the family of the young lover, Morel, might intervene if his habits were known. So he had begun to identify his own position with that described by Balzac. He took refuge, in a sense, in the role, and for the calamity which was perhaps in store for him, and did not in any case cease to alarm him, he had the consolation of finding in his own anxiety what Swann and also Saint-Loup would have called something quite Balzacian. Now, another use of this particular novel is to show the feminine side of Charlus. Of course, the heroine of the novella, Diane, takes the utmost care in the selection of her dresses. And those dresses, the design of those dresses, are so well understood by Charlus that when he compliments Albertine, the narrator's girlfriend, on her costume, he compares it very precisely to the dresses of the Princesse de Cadignan. He was almost the only person capable of appreciating Albertine's clothes at their true value. At a glance, his eye detected what constituted their rarity, justified their price. He would never have said the name of one stuff instead of another, and could always tell who had made them. The woman in Charlus is a good, gentle, generous person, as is proved by the sweetness of that Charlus shows to Albertine, this sort of young, ignorant girl. So I think that when Charlus is in his Saint-Simon mode, he is comical and somewhat ridiculous. But when he is in his Balzac mode, I find him very moving and sensitive, and I think that the reading of Balzac is very, very close to his heart. Now, no writer has been as close to, has been as important to the novel as Racine. Racine was really very, very dear and very important, I would even say essential, to Proust. Now, here again, Proust is only concerned with three plays, Phèdre and the two biblical plays about Jewish queens, Esther and Athalie. Esther and Athalie were commissioned by Madame de Maintenon, Louis XIV's morganatic wife, for Saint-Cyr, the school she had founded for young girls. So all the roles, of course, were played, not only all the roles were played by girls, but it seemed necessary that every pupil should have something to do. After all, it was a school play. I mean, every parent wants to see their daughter up there on the stage. So Racine had the idea of constituting choruses. So in most of the scenes, you had a large group of young girls, sometimes reciting in unison, but most of the time standing around and doing nothing. Now, It probably came quite naturally to Proust, and thus to some of his characters, to imagine these young beauties as boys. So when any of the three old queers, Vaugoubert, the diplomat, Nissim Bernard, who is always identified as Bloch's rich uncle, and of course Charlus, so whenever they pop up, they pop up all the time in the novel, but whenever they are faced with a group of young and idle men, you know, be it busboys or waiters or young men at a Parisian ball, they are reminded of these choruses, of these young girls. And they describe the boys in the precise verses used by Racine. And it's done over and over again. It's really like a sort of leitmotif that introduced any one of these three men. I will just give you an example, because Proust did it very, very cleverly. Vaugoubert is ecstatic because his old friend Charlus has just told him that some of the secretaries at the embassy where Vaugoubert is going to be posted are of his sexual persuasion. Vaugoubert is extremely happy. And the narrator observes him and writes, "Accustomed from childhood to apply even to what is voiceless the language of the classics, I read into Monsieur de Vaugoubert's eyes the lines, 'This palace is filled with girls of Zion, young and tender flowers shaken by fate, transplanted like me under a foreign sky. In a place isolated from profane witnesses, I will take thought and care in training them.'" The use of Racine, of course, goes beyond the simple comical effect because it reinforces the analogy between Jews and homosexuals. I mean, this is a big theme and I can't go into it, but it's very strong in Proust. Now, of course, Phèdre is used very differently and certainly not in a comic way. Phèdre is very intimately linked to the narrator in every stages of his life. The first time Phèdre is alluded to is at the very beginning of the book in Swann's Way. The child has to leave Combray, and he's very sad to leave the countryside and the wonderful flowers and the bushes of hawthorns. "That year my family fixed the day of their return to Paris rather earlier than usual. On the morning of my departure, I had had my hair curled to be ready to face the photographer, had had a new hat carefully set upon my head, and had been buttoned into a velvet jacket. A little later, my mother, searching everywhere for me, found me standing in tears, bidding a long farewell to my hawthorns, clasping their sharp branches to my bosom. And like a princess in a tragedy, oppressed by the weight of all these vain ornaments, with no gratitude towards the importunate hand which had in curling those ringlets been at pains to collect all my hair upon my forehead." There's a great deal lost in translation here, because I'm not sure that an English-speaking audience picks up immediately the verses that are so well known to any French reader. I thought perhaps, as I imagine that a lot of you do understand French, I would just read it in French to show you how wonderfully well done Proust does it. "Comme une princesse de tragédie, à qui pèserait tous ces vains ornements, ingrat envers l'importune main qui, en formant tous ces nœuds, avait pris soin d'assembler mes cheveux." Of course, the important fact is that the child is compared not to a prince, but to a princess. And the identification of the narrator and Phèdre is going to continue all along the novel. The first time the adolescent goes to the theater, it is to see Berma in Phèdre. Later on, when he returns to Berma and Phèdre again, he understands the meaning of great art. Now, you might think that Phèdre is taken as a pretext and that Proust could have taken any other heroine. But in fact, no, it is really Phèdre that the narrator feels close to. And at one point he says, when he reaches a point of crisis in his own life, he says, the Phèdre lines that I have so often read and repeated to myself were a statement of the laws of that I had experienced in my life. I want to put this in context. We are now in The Fugitive, the next to last volume of the series. The narrator has sequestered Albertine, the girl he loves, but once she is completely in his power, he realizes that she is a burden, that she is boring, and he would be very glad to be rid of her. But she takes the first step, and she leaves on her own accord, so he is shattered. Now, isn't this what Phèdre is all about, says the narrator? You know, Phèdre is consumed by her illicit passion for her stepson, Hippolyte, and she would accept to be separated from him if she were the one to banish him. But he comes to tell her that he is leaving, and this provokes this sort of demented cry of passion when she screams out her love for him. He is completely unmoved. And of course, she gets more and more worked up and gets more and more violent because she realizes that actually he is in love with another woman. Now, this is the symbol of, Phèdre is the symbol of l'amour maladie, of love experienced as a sickness. You only love if the other one does not love you. And this is a masochistic conception of love that is crucial to the narrator, to Swann, to Saint-Loup, even to Charlus. It's very strong. So this is when he says that he identifies with Phèdre, it is really with Phèdre. And actually, I think we could go even a little bit further and wonder if Proust, the man, didn't have another reason to show so much empathy to the queen. Phèdre's tragedy comes not only from her unfulfilled love, but also from the conviction that her passion is sinful, shameful, that it is a disgrace. Now, Proust was not a happy homosexual, and he could never bring himself to reveal his true nature to his parents, for instance. So shame, guilt, remorse weighed heavily on him. So I wonder if he is not completely in accord with Phèdre when Phèdre says she's distressed at the idea of dying because she will have to confess crimes so horrible to her father. Her father is Minos, who judges in Hades the souls of the dead. So the sort of feeling that you have to face your parent is something that tortured, actually, Proust. Now, as important as all these writers were for Proust, I think it would be a mistake not to mention the fictional writer, Bergotte, who is also he has a small role, but a very important role in the novel. There is a trio of artists in the novel. There is Elstir the painter, Vinteuil the musician, and Bergotte the writer. Elstir, and even more so Vinteuil, are the subject of distinct narratives in the book. Bergotte has no real story. He first appears in the guise of books. We know that the young man, the narrator, is immersed in Bergotte's work. He adores it, and he's completely obsessed with them. And when Swann tells him that he, Swans, actually knows Bergotte, that he's a friend of Bergotte, that Bergotte is very approachable, that he also is a friend of his daughter Gilberte, with whom the narrator is in love at that time, and offers the narrator to come and have lunch with him, the narrator is, of course, elated. But when he meets Bergotte, he is taken aback. He had, of course, constructed in his mind an image of this writer, and he imagined him as old and frail and very unhappy. And he was not at all ready to face a young man with a snail-shaped nose and a little beard. And besides, he finds that the conversation of Bergotte is not fascinating at all. Of course, this illustrates Proust's theory that you can't judge a writer by the way he behaves in society. And it is also a little sign towards Anatole France, who is one of the models for Bergotte. Anatole France, who wrote so many amusing, comical, ironic novels, was said to be somewhat of a bore in conversation. But nevertheless, the young man becomes, the Bergotte sort of tames the young man. They share a lot of passions, a lot of tastes, and the writer very sweetly encourages the young man to write. And this is also a nod to Anatole France, who encouraged young Marcel Proust and who actually wrote the introduction to the first book he ever published, a collection of essays, Les Plaisirs et les Jours. But as the two men become a little more friendly, the young man is quite upset. He's very troubled by the ugly gossip that surrounds Bergotte. And now I sort of sense a shift. I think Bergotte now says goodbye to Anatole France, and there is a growing confluence between Proust, the man, and his creation, Bergotte. Because, as I said, Proust, as I didn't say yet, but Proust was very, very worried by the way his passages on homosexuality was going to be received by the public. And actually, he was so tormented by that that he warned his publisher again and again not to start publication if he thought he would be shocked himself and want to stop. He was wary of the contradiction that might appear between the sensitivity of a work and the callous or perhaps even vicious life of an author. And the lines that he applies to Bergotte could be very well applied to himself. Would his readers, turning the pages with acute discomfort, arrived to the conclusion that all his literature was a lie and his sensitiveness more play-acting? Perhaps it is only in really vicious lives that the moral problem can arise in all its disquieting strength. And of this problem, the artist finds a solution in the terms not of his own personal life, but what is for him the true life, a general, a literary solution. As the great doctors of the church began often without losing their virtue by acquainting themselves with the sins of all mankind, out of which they extracted their own personal sanctity, so great artists often, while being thoroughly wicked, make use of their vices in order to arrive at a conception of the moral law that is binding upon us all. And from then on, Proust looks at Bergotte as if at himself in a mirror. Bergotte ages rapidly in the book. He becomes ill. He doesn't sleep well. His sleep is interrupted by nightmares, exactly like Proust. He mistrusts all his doctors. He self-medicates himself with terrible imprudence. He mixed narcotics. You know that Proust did it so often that at one point he literally overdosed on laudanum and fell into a coma, a semi-coma, for about 2 days. So Bergotte is really a sort of portrait of Proust in those last years. And Bergotte, and I think any visitor of Proust would recognize Proust in this description of Bergotte. Bergotte never went outdoors, and when he got out of bed for an hour in his room, he would be smothered in shawls, plaids, all the things with which a person covers himself before exposing himself to intense cold or getting into a railway train. He would apologize to the few friends whom he allowed to penetrate to his sanctuary, and pointing to his tartan plaids, his traveling rugs, would say merrily, "After all, my dear fellow, as Anaxagoras had said, life is a journey." Well, finally, it is time for Bergotte to die. But before Proust finishes him off, he sends him to the Jeu de Paume. You know, the Jeu de Paume is this museum, that overlooked the Place de la Concorde. It unfortunately doesn't exist anymore. So he sends him there to see an exhibition of Vermeer. And it is in front of a view from Delft that Bergotte is felled by a stroke. Now, Proust describes here an episode he himself suffered in May 1921, about 18 months before he himself died. He was already very, very ill, but he dragged himself out of his bed. He went to see the Vermeer, and in front of the view from Delft, he fell, victim of a terrible spell of giddiness. The friend who had accompanied him, of course, brought him home, and as soon as they entered the apartment, Proust perked up and called out to his housekeeper, Céleste, bring me my manuscript. I have something to add to Bergotte's death." So you see, at the end, the virtual and the fictional writer literally coalesce. Now, of course, there is a lot of Proust in many of the characters, in the narrator, in the narrator, of course, in Swann, in Saint-Loup, in Tante Léonie, but I think that Bergotte has a place apart, if only because, after all, he lives through his books. And I will end with these final lines about Bergotte. "Bergotte was dead forever, who shall say? Is there not a world entirely different from this, which we leave in order to be born into this world before perhaps returning to the other to live once again? So that the idea that Bergotte was not wholly and permanently dead is by no means improbable. They buried him, but all through the night of mourning, in the lighted windows, his books arranged three by three, kept watch, like angels with outspread wings, and seemed for him who was no more the symbol of his resurrection." I don't think I can add anything to that. Thank you.